We've had a great morning, great afternoon, just been tremendous, and we're going to finish up with another great session tonight. We're blessed tonight. One of Pastor Mark's heart was to discuss the whole flat earth topic, and when we reached out to Brian about that, he said he had the expert for us. And so Dr. Danny Faulkner is here. He drove over from, he said, St. Louis, just to be with us tonight. So huge sacrifice in the midst of his travels, and so I want to give him plenty of time, so let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Danny Faulkner.
Is the earth flat? Well, in a word, no. And there are many reasons why we know the earth is not flat and is a globe, and I will share some of those with you tonight, not all of them by any means. And you may wonder, well, why am I concerned about this? Well, much of my life, our critics have said, have equated creation with belief the earth is flat. And for much of my life, that was hyperbole. And I didn't care about it, you know, because there weren't any flat earthers, really. And so it didn't bother me at all. But then about seven years ago in last February, I discovered that there was a flat earth movement going on, and it really surprised me. Been going on for a year or two at that point, but it's finally reaching critical mass and starting to grow. And so I began to delve into it. What caused me to look into it was, over a week's time, I had three different conversations with three different adults concerned about three different young people who were into this. And I thought there must be something going on, so I dived out there onto the internet to see what was going on. And I spent a lot of time working at it. I've been to three Flat Earth International conventions and met many of the people. I got to know some of the speakers, and I've actually made friends with several of them, many of them actually. One of them called me back. He was a host of the first couple of meetings, and he called me just a couple of weeks ago, and we chatted for 45 minutes probably, and it was good. I do have friends in the Flat Earth movement. You don't have to treat them as a pariah. Also, I read numerous books from many over 100 years ago, and I read a number of articles, and I've watched far more hours of YouTube videos about it than I would care to even guess that I've done. So I've done my homework. I've looked at it at great depth. And you might say, well, didn't we settle this question 5 centuries ago with Christopher Columbus? Didn't he prove the earth is a globe? Well, no, we didn't actually settle it back then. You see, we settled it 2,500 years ago. And that's part of the problem, is all of us were taught at an early age that what I call the Columbus myth. How many of you were taught when you were growing up that everybody thought the world was flat until 500 years ago? How many? Come on. Almost every hand should go up. And I was quite surprised when I was reading on my own in high school, probably sophomore year, I said, well, wait a minute. You mean people thought it was a globe before that? Yeah. Turns out Pythagoras, you heard of him, Pythagorean theorem, around 6th century BC, he said that the earth is a globe. Now, we don't have his writings. They don't survive. We do have later accounts of him, of what he said. But unfortunately, they don't record his reasons. We can only speculate about what those might have been. And then Parmenides in the 5th century also said the earth is a globe. And so it goes forward. Many, many people, by 400 BC or so, it was pretty well established in the Western world that the earth was a globe. And many people are shocked to learn that. Now, I will commend the flat earthers. They do raise some good points sometimes. They really do. And they raise some good questions many times. And one of these is that they raise a very good epistemological study. And most of you are probably scratching your head saying, epistle what? Well, epistemology is this word. And I've got the Merriam-Webster definition of it. It says it's a study or a theory of the nature and grounds of knowledge, especially with reference to its limits and validity. Again, that's kind of complicated. Let me put it in what Paul Harvey used to call shirt sleeve English. Epistemology is how we know what we know. And that's, there's a whole field of study dealing with that. How do you know certain things? And if you read about philosophy, going back to the ancient Greeks again, they ask that question a lot. You know, how do we know what we know? And how can we be sure of things and so forth? And so one question is, how do you know the earth is a globe? And when people ask me that question, I like to go with the classics. Two of them that are due to Aristotle. And these, I like these because anybody can do these and see these for themselves. You don't have to worry about NASA giving you pictures from space or anything. You don't need that. You can do this on your own. And one of these is the fact that during a total lunar eclipse, the shape of the Earth's shadow is always a circle. I've seen, I think now, 17 total lunar eclipses and various other partial lunar eclipses, and I've confirmed this for myself. It's always circular. Now, this is a photograph I took a few years ago during a total lunar eclipse. I had a telescope, it's a Questar telescope, 3.5-inch. Anybody here do photography seriously? Anybody? Nobody? I was going to try to impress somebody. The focal length on the Questar is 1,300 millimeters. Anybody that knows anything about lenses will tell you that's a whale of a telephoto lens. And it runs circles around the P900 and the P1000 and Nikon makes. It really does. It's optically far better, and it's got a longer focal length by quite a bit over what those bridge cameras have. So I attached my digital SLR camera to the telescope, and this has not been altered at all. This is just the JPEG image that I got out of it. It nearly fills the frame in the landscape mode here vertically. They designed the telescope that way, so you nearly fill the frame up with the sun or the moon. This is about, a 13-second exposure taken during totality. It's a little reddish looking because, as you probably know, lunar eclipses do that. There's an explanation for that I won't go into. There's a star to the upper left that you can see. That star wouldn't show up ordinarily when the moon's bright because the moon's too bright. You have to take a very short exposure to capture the moon without overexposing it. 13 seconds is an awful long time. I think the ISO is 400 or 800, probably 800 when I took this. It's also deeper red and darker at the bottom because it's near the center of the Earth's shadow. Up near the top, it's less dark, it's brighter, and it's less red. It actually still is quite dark. Remember, this is a 13-second exposure. Now, I took a bunch of photographs during the totality, but also before and after totality. It's preceded by partial phases, and here is one of those pictures. I'm reproducing this smaller than the last one, and you can see there that there is a dark shadow in the moon. It's normally full, and it should be fully lit. And can you tell the shape of that shadow? Well, I can show you one after the eclipse. These were taken like a half hour before and a half hour after totality. And the moon was moving from right to left through the Earth's shadow. Now, can you see the shape of the shadow? Well, if you're really not seeing it, I can help you out. I can draw it in for you like that. And it turns out the shadow of the moon, of the Earth, the Earth's umbra is about 5/3 the size of the moon. It's actually larger than the moon is. And that's why you can have total eclipses. If it weren't as big as the moon was, you would never have total lunar eclipses, but it is larger. It's about 5,000 miles across, and the moon's only about 2,000 miles across. As I said, Aristotle wrote about this in a book called On the Heavens, that he wrote around 350 BC, but he had other reasons. One is the altitude of stars in the northern and southern parts of the sky, and some of you will recognize where this photograph was taken. It's just outside of Imzara's restaurant at the Ark Encounter, and you're not going to see this yourself because this is at night. A few years ago, an amateur astronomer friend of mine, he's a pastor of a church, supporter of AIG, comes to the pastor's conference every year because he's a pastor too, bivocational, and we got permission to go to the Ark Encounter and spend half the night, and it took a while to get the lights turned off. They're not like switches someplace. They're circuit breakers, and can you get those lights over there turned off? And they had to look for them for half an hour. Okay, that's good. Can you get these over here? And it took a long while to get them down, and my friend set up his camera out there and took a 30-minute exposure. And you can see the stars making this circular pattern, concentric. And near the middle, there's a little dot right above the bow fin on the arc. And that is Polaris, what we call the North Star. And as it turns out, the sky is observed to spin around the sky around a point we call the North Celestial Pole. It's about 3/4 of a degree from Polaris. So Polaris actually goes through a small circle. I've got a time-lapse video I did with a telescope with a 440 millimeter focal length. And I took photographs over about 10 hours, I believe. And I've got this time-lapse video where where Polaris actually spins around showing you that's the case. It's not motionless. It actually does have a slight turn. And I would interpret that as being the rotation axis of the Earth pointing in that direction. And either the sky is spinning around that axis or the Earth is spinning around that axis. And observationally, you can't distinguish between those two. But it is spinning around that point in the sky. And let me illustrate what I'm talking about here. That angle you see that Polaris makes, or that North Celestial Pole, that angle it makes is equal to your latitude. For around the arc, it's a little less than 39 degrees. But if you go farther north, it's going to be higher. If you go farther south, it's going to be lower. Let me illustrate what's going on. This green circle represents the Earth. And then you've got this vertical line going through it that represents the rotation axis of the Earth. And so if you extended that rotation axis of the Earth up above and down below, that would intersect the sky in the North Celestial Pole and the South Celestial Pole. And Polaris, or the North Star, is really close to that point. For the sake of argument, let me just say Polaris, or the North Star, rather than the North Celestial Pole. Good enough. Now, halfway between, that would be the equator. That's your line there. And let me pick a location on the Earth, say the arc encounter. And right there, I'm going to draw a line from the center of the Earth to that point up on the surface of the Earth. And I think most of you would recognize from school that the angle between the equator that I drew, the horizontal line, and that second line I just drew there is equal to your latitude. Again, I suggested this by this, it's a little less than halfway. 45 degrees would be halfway. And you can see it's a little less, so it's close to 39 degrees. Now, if you're standing at that end of that point, the Earth is going to block the view of everything to the lower left. You can see everything to the other right. There's a plane that's tangent to the Earth at that point, and that will define your horizon. Let me just suggest what it looks like there, a little circle there. Now you see it on the edge. It's going to be kind of foreshortened. And that's going to be your horizon. It actually would extend out way up above to the upper left and to the lower right, but I'm just showing you that. And the sky does have a dome-like appearance to us. It doesn't mean it is a dome. It's just the appearance we get, because when we're looking in the sky, things are so far away, we don't have depth perception. Everything in the sky appears to be the same distance away from us. So if I'm standing here, if I look at an object over here and over here and over here and over here and over here, and they all seem to be the same distance from me, that defines a hemisphere, doesn't it? Very easily. It doesn't mean they're that far away. It just means we lack depth perception to do that. We only see in 2D when things are far enough away we can't use our stereoscopic vision of our two eyeballs. Now, I could draw a line from my position on the Earth there parallel to that rotation axis. And then I can draw another line that's tangent to the Earth right there. That would represent my north direction. And that angle between those two lines I just drew is the same as the angle between those other two lines I drew earlier. That is, that's equal to your latitude. I don't have time to go through this, but it's a very nice geometry proof. If you've taken geometry, you can go through this and show this. It's not very difficult to do that. Now, that's what the sky looks like where I would live, and the stars would all spin around that vertical line that I drew at my location. Notice that the stars on the upper left there are going to be real low in the northern horizon. The other direction to the south, they're going to be lower in the sky. Now, what happens if I go farther north on the Earth, say up into Canada somewhere? It's going to look like that, isn't it? Let me toggle back and forth. Kentucky, Ontario, Kentucky, Ontario, Kentucky, Ontario, Kentucky, Ontario. And again, that angle there between those two lines, the last two and the latitude, are going to be the same. And this talks about what I'm saying there, that the Earth, the North Celestial Pole or the Polaris gets higher, and it's equal to your latitude. In fact, for every 69 statute miles or 60 nautical miles you travel northward, the North Star is going to get 1 degree higher. And for every 69 statute miles you go southward, it's going to get that much lower in the sky. Ditto, stars in the southern part of the sky are going to get higher and lower too. There are stars I can see in Kentucky down in the south you cannot see in Ontario because of this. And it's very monotonic in that behavior. Now, flat earthers sometimes say, well, we can, by moving on our flat earth, we can, you know, Polaris is going to appear higher and lower. Yes, it will. However, it will not shift 1 degree in altitude for every 69 miles you go. That's just the reality of geometry. If a flat earther knows, understands the aspects of the sky, he's going to see that will not work in their model. By the way, what happens if I go to the southern hemisphere? Well, it's going to look something like this. There's a rotation axis, the equator. There's a location down there, down south. I can put in my my little horizon, and there's my dome, and notice that the North Star cannot be seen, but the South Celestial Pole can be seen. There are two points in the sky around which the stars appear to spin. That is perfectly works perfectly well on a spherical Earth. It doesn't work at all on the flat Earth model. Okay, those are two evidence that Aristotle talked about in 350 BC. If you want more evidence, in the first century AD, Pliny the Elder wrote, he said, as ships move away, they disappear bottom first. So the hull disappears, and finally up and up, and the sail disappears. If a ship's coming towards you, the reverse happens. The sail is visible first, and then as it comes closer, more of the ship is revealed down to the hull. Now, I suspect without optical aid, that's going to be very difficult to do, but I think he understood that this would happen if you could see that well. But there was something he did know about for sure. If a person is on top of the mast and you're sailing towards land, you are going to see the land up there before you will see it on the deck of the ship. That's why they put a scout, a crow's nest, on top to do that. And this is incontrovertible. So if the Earth is a globe, then you would expect that as a ship moves away, that you ought to see less and less of the bottom of the ship. Now, if the Earth is flat, that's not going to be the case as it moves away. So it's a very good test between the two. And so I've done this. I don't live near a large body of water, but about 6 years ago, I was visiting in Virginia Beach. And so there's a major port there. And I went out to the beach one day, and I set my, again, the telescope I showed told about before, the Questar, 1,300 millimeter focal length. I set it up near the water there on the bay, and I set up the telescope and the camera, and I think it was about 6 feet above the level of the water. Not quite sure about that. I wanted to avoid waves lapping up at me at some point. And I watched some ships come and go. Here's a container ship, one in particular. On the side there, it says the NYK Line. That's a major Japanese shipping firm. You may have seen their ships before. And you see a bunch of about seven stacks that are visible there of containers, different colors, and the superstructure, the white superstructure in the back of the ship. And notice that even behind that superstructure, there are some containers stacked up to it. Now, I've seen many of their ships in port, and those letters, NYK Line, do not extend down to the waterline. There are several reasons for that. One of them is it's just going to be difficult to maintain those things, plus they won't be very visible. So as I'm looking at it right now, I can tell that there is something obstructing the bottom of the ship, and that something looks like water out there in the bay. And if the Earth is flat, that shouldn't happen. If it's a globe, there should be a dome of water, a hump of water between me and the ship, and that's exactly what I'm seeing. Now, as the ship got farther away, it got more obscured. Now, you can tell the ship's farther away because it's smaller, and I have reproduced these at the same scale, these pictures. I've not changed the scale on you. And you can see everything on the ship is smaller than it was before. That's because it's getting farther away. Notice you can't see the hole anymore, can you? The NYK, it's completely obscured. Later on, the ship cleared the Chesapeake Bay, probably was heading to Europe because it started to turn more to the north. We're looking at the stern. Remember those, those containers are stacked up behind the that white superstructure, and eventually you didn't see any containers in the back end at all. You're just seeing the very tip top of the ship. Unfortunately, this was in November. The nights are long and the days are short, and I was running out of time. The sun was setting. I was already increasing the exposure time to get this one, and I could not keep following the ship. I wish I could have, but I couldn't. Sunset was about to take place, in which case the ship's going to disappear anyway from my view. So, more recently, I was down in Florida, was it last year or year before, South Florida, and I took this photograph of a ship. I believe it was approaching what port was it? Fort Lauderdale port, I believe. I think it's Fort Lauderdale. I think. Are they the same thing? Okay, very good. I was in Broward County, so I was looking north. Okay, I don't know. Thank you. I knew Fort Lauderdale was there. I didn't know it was the same. I thought Fort Everglades is farther south. I don't know which port it is. But he was heading towards the port, obviously, and you can see there are three humps there. There's what it turned out to be the back of the ship, that big white thing. The far left, there's a thing sticking up. That's in the bow of the ship, and the thing in the middle is in the middle of the ship. You can't see the hull, you can't see the deck, you can't see a good deal of the ship. And I didn't know what I was looking at yet because it was coming toward me, and it was far out there. And then I took another picture a little later on, and I got a little closer, and son of a gun, there it is. I can see now more of all three of those, and I get a better idea of what they are and where they are. And then a little later on, a little bit more, and it's turning, and then I can see even more. Just the reverse of what I just showed you. Before I showed you a ship departing, now I'm showing a ship coming toward, and it works either way. So you can get all three of these coming together very quickly for a comparison on these things. Again, very good evidence. Going back to Pliny the Elder, I've seen it with myself. I've photographed it. I've documented. If the earth is a globe, this is exactly what you would expect to see. I see that. Therefore, the earth is a globe. Now, Eratosthenes lived around 200 BC, and he did one of the most amazing things. I used to share this with my students and try to get them excited about it as well. He lived in Alexandria. It was a Greek city of learning and culture, and he, by the way, was the father of geography. If you hate geography, then you know who to hate, because Eratosthenes coined that term. He loved maps and surveying and all that sort of stuff. Now, how did he measure the size of the earth? Circumference and then divide by 2 pi to get the radius. Well, remember, he lived in Alexandria up in northern Egypt, but he knew either by his own observation or by someone telling him, we don't know, but about 500 miles to the south was a little city called, a town called Syene. Today it's at modern day Aswan. And it was reported that there was a deep well there, and at noon, local noon, on the June solstice, you could see the bottom of the well. Now, if you ever look down into a deep well, you'll know one thing. You can't see the bottom. The reason, unless you have a light that shines down, if you're going by in the daytime and don't have any kind of strong light, the vertical shaft is here. The sun is not directly overhead unless you're in the tropics. The light comes down like this, and it puts the bottom of the well in perpetual shadow, and you cannot see the bottom. So if it's a shallow well, you can, but if it's a deep well, you can't. But on the June solstice at noon, you could see the fully illuminated well at the bottom. That meant one thing. That meant that the sun was directly overhead. Today, we'd recognize that it's on the Tropic of Cancer, the northernmost parts of the tropics. Well, knowing this, he knew in Alexandria, Eratosthenes knew the sun never was directly overhead. So how far off of overhead was it? Well, you got to realize that he knew the sun was very far away. And flat earthers like to dispute this, but the thing is, the sun is very far away compared to the size of the earth. So if you move 500 miles on the surface of the earth, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference. So sometimes people will disparage how he did this. They call it sticks in the sand. He did something far better than that. The Greeks were good architects. They were good engineers. He built a gnomon. A gnomon is a post that you use for casting shadows. Sundials have a gnomon on them. And so he built this gnomon. We don't know if it was made out of wood or stone, but he had a gnomon that was vertical, and he knew it was vertical because, again, they were good engineers. And he had a level place around it. They could level things up. If you look at some of the architecture they had, it was very well done. And so on the June solstice, on a different year, he watched the sun, the shadow of the gnomon, and in the morning it was over in the northwest, but as the day progressed, it got shorter, it rotated around, pointed due north when it was at shortest, and then it started getting longer again. And all he did is he measured the length of that shadow. So if you look at this, you have a vertical gnomon like this, and he knew the length of it, the height of it, because he built it. And he measured the shadow down here, and you've got a right angle here, so you've got a right triangle. You know one leg, you know the other leg, and if you measure one of these angles like this, then you know the other angle, and you can also figure out the sides, can't you? It's called trigonometry, right? And the Greeks invented that, hence the name trigonometry, three-sided measure. So he measured this, and when he did, he got the one length here, and he got the other length here, and he took their ratio and figured out what the angle was, and he expressed it in a fraction of a circle. We don't do it that way today generally, but that's what he did then, and it was about 1/50th of a circle, which works out to be 7.2 degrees if you want to do it in degrees. Now, what that told him is that the difference in latitude between the two locations, those two dotted lines going to the center of the earth, he knew that that was the same angle. It was 1/50th of a circle. So if those two locations are separated by 1/50th of a circle, all he had to do is measure how far it was between those two cities, multiply by 50, and he gets the circumference. And did he know the distance between them? Well, yeah, he's the father of geography. He commissioned surveying and all that stuff, and they got the distance pretty well. And he got the circumference of the earth pretty well. He used the unit of length called the stadium. And there were, unfortunately, there were two stadia in use at the time. And we don't know which one he used. If he used the more common one, then his value was off by about 20% from the correct value. Not bad. But if he used the less commonly used one, he was off by 0.5%. Are you impressed with what I just shared with you? If you are not, then you have utterly failed to understand what I just said. This is incredible. 2,200 years ago, they not only know the size of the earth, but they knew how big it was to within 20%. Let's just be really, really fair about it and say it's within 20%. So how did this flat earth myth arise? Well, it all came about in the 19th century, and there were three major developments that I blame this upon. One of them was the development of archaeology, the science of digging up the past. By the way, I heard the other day, a little trivia. Did you know that most archaeologists are women? I didn't know that. You know why? It's because women are so good at digging up the past. I'm glad you're laughing. The women are laughing too, and I appreciate that fact, all right? All right, so archaeology as we know it developed, and the British did that, and at that time the British ruled everything it seemed like, and so they went to Mesopotamia, they're in charge of, and Egypt for that matter, and they were just going excavating everywhere, and they discovered this cosmology. And this cosmology they found was a flat disc with a dome over top of it. And they said, aha, this is the cosmology of the ancient Near East. And I put that in quotes there. Do you know why I do that? Well, that became established as the cosmology of the ancient Near East. But then a few years later, they discovered that it wasn't. It was just a cosmology of the ancient Near East. There were a bunch of them, actually. Now, about the same time, they developed this thing called the documentary hypothesis. Y'all familiar with that? It's this idea coming out of German liberalism in the 19th century. They said, look, if Moses even existed at all, he did, by the way, but if he did, he didn't write the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. They were written about 1,000 years later at the time or shortly after the Babylonian captivity. And they picked up their creation story from them and the flood myth from them and their cosmology. And that's where we get the book of Genesis from all of this. You should recognize that as nothing less than a direct assault and attack on the integrity and the authority and inspiration of Scripture. But that became scholarship. Now, conservative scholars said no thanks, and they didn't consider it anymore. But the liberals kind of hung on to it for a while. It's kind of fallen on hard times. But you see, if this is the cosmology of the ancient Near East, then that must be the cosmology of the Bible. And unfortunately, in the 1990s, a guy named Seeley, he was a guy, a biblical scholar supposedly, he dug this up. It'd been dead for 100 years, but he dug it up and he said, aha, this is what Genesis is all about. That thing on day two that God made, the firmament in the King James, the expanse in more modern translations, it's that dome over top of the earth, and it's been peddling this. And soon John Walton began to peddle that as well. And then Michael Heiser really got a hold of it. And I've heard talks by the late Michael Heiser. He died recently. He showed these diagrams, and I'll show you something like this kind of diagram with this dome over top and this flat earth underneath. He said, this is the cosmology of the Bible. This is the cosmology the Bible teaches. What has he just done here? By the way, Michael Heiser doesn't believe this cosmology. He believed the earth is a globe. What he's just done is he said, look, the Bible has a huge mistake in it at the very first chapter. And yet this is a man, I believe, who declared he believed in the inspiration authority of Scripture. And I think the man was very confused on this matter. But a lot of flat earthers have picked this up and they show these little diagrams. See, right here it says this is what the Bible's like. This is a myth that came about in the 19th century, the latter part of the 19th century. And at the same time, there's this thing called the conflict thesis. The conflict thesis is this idea that Christianity or religion, but Christianity in particular, and progress and science have been at loggerheads all throughout the Middle Ages. And their exhibit A in this was that the Bible and Christianity and the church taught that the earth was flat. And you got egg on your face when Columbus showed otherwise. And so now you have a chance to redeem yourself by getting in on the ground floor of Darwinism. And it worked. Many churchmen actually capitulated, even though the whole thing was a complete fabrication. And that, folks, is where the Columbus myth came from. All right. This is a picture, a depiction that came from a Bible from around 1350. How do we know it's from 1350? Well, it was belonged to King John the Good of France. And he reigned about that time. And in 1356, I think September, we know the exact date, the English defeated the French in the Battle of Poitiers. And he was there at the battlefield, and they were defeated. And so then the English winning, they could take whatever they wanted. And they took this Bible from him. We know the exact date the English snatched it from him. And it's been in continual possession of the English ever since. And this is a little folio from inside of his Bible. It depicts the second day of creation. You see Jesus as the creator, because we know from the New Testament, John writing about that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he talks to say he was the creator. Everything was made by him, and nothing was made that was not made by him. Well, what do you see there? You see the earth, and surrounding that is water above this expanse from day two. And what shape is the earth? It's a ball. This is 150 years before Columbus. So it turns out there are many medieval depictions of a globe earth. This idea that it was created a few hundred years ago is not true. It's not supportable by the evidence. So how did people get into this flat earth business? Well, there's a guy named Samuel Rowbottom. He was an Englishman. He lived in the 19th century. And he performed what's called the Bedford Level experiment. Bedford Level is this place in the eastern end of England. Pretty, no hills to speak of. Pretty flat. And the river has been kind of straightened out for about 6 miles before you get to the ocean. And so you got this river that's pretty flat. And he said, look, if I get myself down in the water at point A, you can see Rowbottom. By the way, this is from his book. He wrote two books. Both books had this little figure in it. You can see Rowbottom there at point A, and he's gotten down into the water with a tripod, and he has a telescope that's 8 inches above the water. Now, why 8 inches? Well, if you look up or work it out yourself, you will find that if the Earth is a globe 25,000 miles across, then if you position yourself 8 inches above a flat surface like water, then your sight will be tangent to the Earth 1 mile away. And so you can see he starts at point A, and then there at point T is 1 mile from him, and his vision there is tangent to it. And so anything beyond that could be obscured. So what he did is he got somebody to get in a rowboat, and he put a big flag or placard or something up, big white screen that you could see, and he asked that person to row down the entire length. And for that first mile, everything was fine, but he realized that once he got past the first mile and went the additional 5 miles to the end, that he should go on over the curvature of the earth. And as he did, when you finally get out the total 6 miles, 5 miles from that tangent point, you should have something like 24 feet of curvature. And the boat wasn't nearly that high. The boat was like 6 or 8 feet high. So after the person goes the other end, it should not be visible at all if the earth is a globe of 25,000 miles circumference. Everybody understand the proposition here? Well, when he did this experiment, he saw the boat the entire way. Huh. So he said, aha, the globe earth predicts that it should be obscured, but it's not obscured, so therefore the earth must not be a globe and the earth must be flat. And that became his exhibit A, and today flat earthers, they don't use his argument so much, but they use more modern examples. They say we see too far. Now, is that what I showed you before? I showed you two different sets of pictures, two different times, and I didn't get the same results he got. So am I lying? Is he lying? Is one of us mistaken, one of us wrong? What's going on? Well, it turns out there's an effect going on here. It's called atmospheric refraction. And this is something that flat earthers will dispute with us all the time. But it's caused when there's a temperature inversion. What do I mean by that? Well, you all know from grade school science that the surface temperature, the air temperature at the surface is usually the warmest. And then as you go upward in elevation, what happens to the temperature? It decreases, doesn't it? And, you know, even here in Tennessee, the mountains are not really tall, but you can see that for yourself. I'll go home tomorrow. I'll go up Interstate 75 up Pine Mountain, the Cumberland Mountains there, and I expect the temperature probably go down a little bit because I'm going to go up a couple thousand feet. If you go over the Smokies, the same thing will happen. The Blue Ridge, the same thing will happen. You know that the temperature decreases with increasing elevation. There's some good physical reasons for that. I won't go into that, but you just know that's the case. However, if you're next to a large body of water, and it's a warm spring or summer day, will the water temperature be the same, warmer or cooler than the air temperature, usually, in the summer or spring? It'll be cooler, won't it? Because you see, water has a high specific heat, one of the highest of any substance. It takes a lot of heat addition to raise its temperature and a lot of heat subtraction to cool it back down again. And so on a warm summer day or spring day, the water of a large body of water is almost always cooler than the air temperature. It'd be really rare if it isn't. Now, the air that comes in contact with that water is going to get chilled. And you're going to end up with a layer of chilled air, cooler air, and then above that, a layer of warmer air, and then decrease above that. So you get this warmer above, cooler below, and that's called an inversion. It's a very stable situation, by the way, so it can persist for quite a while. So if you take a light ray from that boat and you extend it back towards row bottom, it's going to go straight normally and just zip right up into the higher levels of the atmosphere and go, and you'll never be seen by row bottom. However, if there is a temperature inversion, there's a problem because the speed of light depends upon a couple of things. One of them is the temperature of the air. Cooler air has a slower speed for light. And so as that red ray of light starts to go upward and ascend into a cooler, warmer layer of air, it's leaving a slower speed of light and entering into a faster speed of light. And whenever that happens, you always get refraction bending back down, in this case, into the slower medium. It's called Snell's Law. It's been understood physics and physicists for a very long time. I learned this in high school. And so when you have a temperature inversion, that light can bend over many, many miles, as it turns out, allowing you to see too far. Now, it happens with all waves. I encounter it where I live quite frequently with sound. I live not very far from the Creation Museum. I live in an area called North Bend. If you want to know where I live, get a map of Kentucky out and look for the most northern part you can find, and that's where I live. I am surrounded by Ohio because the Ohio River does this, and I'm there. I'm real close. I'm within a mile or two of the Ohio River and surrounded by it to a large extent. Like I said, I'm surrounded by the state of Ohio because that's the border. Now, on cool nights and cool mornings particularly, the temperature falls, and I hear something I don't normally hear. You see, there's an entrenched meander. The Ohio River is a couple hundred feet lower than I am, and there are big hills on either side, particularly on the Kentucky side. And normally, there's a railroad track over there on the other side, on the Ohio side, and normally the sound comes up like this, hits this bluff over here. I'm over here, and I'm in a shadow. I can't hear the sound because the sound is directed up this way. But on a cold morning or a cold night, it comes up, it's in, the air sinks down, it's cool, it comes up, it tries to enter into the warmer air where the speed of sound is a lot faster, and the air, the sound is bent over the edge like this, and I will sit there and I can hear the rumbling of the train wheels, I can hear the horn of the train, I can even hear the horns of the barges on the river, but I can't hear it during the daytime, and I can't hear it on warm nights or warm mornings. If it's cloudy, for instance, if it's clear, I almost always hear it. By the way, to the south of me is Interstate 275, and there's a ridge between us, and I don't hear it except on cold nights or cold mornings, and the same thing's going on. It's, again, refraction, in this case, with sound waves. It's a well-understood phenomenon, so when flat earthers just dismiss it and say, well, it isn't happening, they don't understand the physics at all because it's very well understood. Now, another famous example they like to use is this famous, actually different photographs of this type. This is a photograph taken by Joshua Nowicki. It shows you the Chicago skyline. If you know the skyline of Chicago, you can pick out some of the better-known buildings. And he took this picture from a state park in western Michigan, more than 50 miles away, looking across Lake Michigan. And if you do the calculation, you'll find you got a couple thousand feet of curvature that should be blocking your view, and you can't see it. So therefore, flat earthers say this proves the earth is flat and not a globe. But keep in mind, Joshua Nowicki is not a flat earther. He believes the earth is a globe, but he's a very good photographer, and he knows his trade, and he knows the weather conditions that this could be made possible. He has a super zoom lens that he gets out there, and the conditions are just right. And why does he do this? Well, because this is a very provocative picture. You're seeing something you shouldn't be able to see, but you're seeing it. Most of the time, you're just going to get a blank skyline, but this isn't provocative, and he knows what he's doing. He only does this when he knows the conditions are right for doing it. And by the way, he's made time-lapse videos he puts together, and the skyline bops up and down like this because the refraction changes. If the earth is flat and you're seeing it because for that reason, it shouldn't be bobbing up and down, but with the globe, it does. And again, contrast with my earlier photos, I don't get that. You know why? Remember I said that I was in Virginia Beach? It was a cold November day. The temperature started out was 50, and it was 49 by the time I finished, and the water temperature was 62 degrees. There was no temperature inversion. Here's the rub. When do you want to go to the beach? On a cold autumn or winter day, or on a warm spring or summer day? Yeah, everybody wants to do the latter, wimps. And so I went out there, and I was freezing out there and doing my due diligence. If you go out on a cold winter or autumn day when the water's warmer than the air, you're not going to see too far. The thing is, everybody goes out on the warm spring and summer days, and refraction is a common thing at that point. I've done this several times, and I have yet to get the results the flat earthers get. I suspect many of them get the results I get, and they just simply ignore those, and they select out the data that they want to champion because it agrees with what they've chosen to believe. That is fundamentally dishonest to do that. Okay, another example. This is one that people put up there all the time. This is what they call the famous black swan. A guy, a flat earther in 2016, made this video. It's only 10 or 12, 15 minutes long. I've watched the video myself several times, and he positions his camera, tells a zoom camera out there on the Southern California beach, 6 feet above the water. He's got these two platforms out there, Hill House and Habitat. He gives the distance away, and he does the numbers, and he said, look, given my position, the horizon should be in front of those two oil platforms. Obviously, the horizon's behind them. So bye-bye, ball, they say, because this black swan proves that the earth is flat and not a globe. Now, I want you to look at that platform on the left. You see that derrick going up like that? What do you notice about it? It's kind of wavy, isn't it? Do you think the derrick really looks like that? No, in fact, this is what the derrick looks like. It's pretty straight, isn't it? And by the way, while you're looking at it, what do you notice about the horizon? The one on the right is partially obscured, just as you expect, and the one on the left, it's even more obscured because it's farther away, just as you expect that the Earth is a globe. Two different pictures showing you something very different, aren't you? Well, I would submit to you that the one on the left, the upper left, was taken at a time when there was a temperature inversion present, when refraction was there, and refraction can be quite variable. And in fact, the fact that you see that wavy derrick there, that crane, that's evidence of extreme refraction going on. But the one below, the lower right, I don't see any of that. The picture on the lower right is consistent with the Earth being a globe, 25,000 mile circumference. The one on the upper left is not. So how do I explain that? I've just done that. I've explained refraction. Now, it's funny. The flat earthers claim to have watched this video, and it's made by a flat earther. But he was unusually honest in this, and I took screenshots. You know what he said about the photograph on the upper left? This is a screenshot from the video that they all like. He said this, most days, normal visibility of platforms and boats will appear they are behind the horizon, curvature of Earth. Now, it's dramatically really messed up. But what's he saying there? He's saying, most of the time, most days, I will go out and I will see the kind of photograph, actually, I'm talking about the one on the lower right. He said, this is what happened most days. I will see the lower right. I will see evidence of curvature of the earth. He just admitted that. But he said, once in a while, not very often, there will be days when conditions are right to see the full images. That is, the rare instance is the upper left, and the very common instance is on the lower right. Once again, he's thrown out probably the 99 out of 100 times that he sees evidence of curvature, and he keeps the one time that he sees doesn't see curvature, and that proves the earth is flat to him. Folks, that is dishonest. There's no other word for it. So Rowbottom starts this thing with the Bedford Level experiment in the mid-1800s. He then writes a book under a pseudonym, and then finally a later edition under his own name, and he goes around speaking, and this whole movement is born under Rowbottom's leadership and influence. He was a very charismatic person, apparently. And the movement grew tremendously. Rowbottom died by 1889, I think. And then a few other people took over, and the movement kind of peaked maybe in the 1890s, but by 1900 it was starting to decline. And as you get into the first couple of decades of the 20th century, the movement waned considerably and basically disappeared. There was the famous Flat Earth Society that was founded in 1956 by an Englishman. And he knew about Rowbottom, and he tried to get attention. It was a very bad timing for him because the next year was Sputnik. And for the next decade or 12 years, people always went to this guy, Mr. Shenton, and asked him about, you know, what's with his moon programs and astronauts and such, because they wanted to get the cranks attitude on this. And it really was a shame because they were making fun of the poor man. But he was the lone, one of the lone flat earthers for many years. Eventually, there were other flat earth societies. He died, and it kind of died away, and somebody else took over. But then there was a Canadian flat earth society in the 70s that was entirely tongue-in-cheek. And so flat earth society has a mixed reputation. By the way, modern flat earthers, for the most part, dismiss the flat earth society, saying that it's a shill, it's a plant from the powers that be, NASA and so forth, to fake people out. But I've been to their website, looked at the stuff and what they have there archived, and their arguments are almost completely the same as the other flat earthers. How in the world they can diss them and yet promote the same arguments is a mystery to me. And the flat earth movement revived again about 7, 8, 9 years ago. Somebody discovered some of the early writings. A guy named Eric DeBay did that, and he began to promote those, and then the movement took off. And I think social media and YouTube made that possible. Yeah, I don't think 20 years ago this could have happened because you didn't have that rapid response to get out there to people. And I keep saying the internet is going to be the death of us yet. And so you get all these flat earth scientists that are certified YouTube scientists out there. And as I studied this, I have found a very broad range of theological beliefs. It is huge. Early on, I kept hearing them say there are no atheist flat earthers because they say this domed flat disc with a sitting here is so contrived it couldn't have possibly have evolved. And I think that was largely true, but now there are a few flat earth atheists, so they don't say that much anymore because there are a few out there, but not many. But you find people who profess Christ, these are Christians that claim the Bible as their authority to argue for flat earth. You have other people who quote the Bible, but judging by their actions, their attitudes, and their language is just totally foul. I don't think some people are Christian at all. But there are some very devout Christians tied up into this, I do believe. Then there are Hindus and they're Muslims. I mean, this is just, they're New Agers. It's all over the place. When I first encountered this 7 years ago, I got thinking, well, these are just biblical flat earthers. No, they're just a small part of it. The diversity is incredible. The only thing they seem to have in common is belief the earth is flat. Beyond that, everything's up for grabs. And there's a lot of infighting, a lot of back and forth that people have in the movement. Okay, so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the supposed biblical arguments for flat earth. It's not going to be exhaustive. I have a chapter in my book about this, and it's not even exhaustive, but I took some of the passages that I see used again and again and again and I want to discuss those. And again, it won't be complete. Many of them, I've seen lists of like 200 Bible verses that prove the earth is flat. Another one's 240. And then there's a guy named Orlando Ferguson back in the 1890s who claimed 400, but I've never seen his list. I have seen the 200 and 240 list, and I've gone through it, and I'm totally amazed by some of the claims that they make. For instance, they point out this thing made on day two, firmament in King James, expanse. By the way, I think the firmament's a terrible translation of the Hebrew word rakia there, expanse in more modern translations. Its purpose was to separate waters above from waters below. Later on day four, God placed the luminaries there. And again, the early English translations were firmament, and there's a long story as to why that happened. I don't have time to talk about it. But today, they use the word expanse. You know why they modern translations translate rakia as expanse? It's very simple, folks. That's what the word means. I know a couple of world-class Hebraists, and they tell me that. And if you work the lexicons, they tell you that. Now, some of those is like a third definition. We'll say, thought of by the ancient Hebrews as being a dome over the flat earth. Now, wait a minute. That's not a definition of the word, is it? It's telling you what some 19th and 20th century men think that ancient Hebrew men thought the rakia was. You got two levels of interpretation there on this, and it's not very certain at all. People have known its expanse for a very long time. Martin Luther knew that. John Calvin knew that. So it's been known for a long time that it means expanse. They also point out, this is on the list, according to Genesis 1:1-2, and also verses 14 and 18, that God made the sun before the earth. Made the earth before the sun. And I agree with that. That's what the Genesis 1 says, but how does that prove the earth is flat? I'm serious. I read this and I think, you've got this in a list of Bible verses that say the earth is flat, and there's nothing in there that would suggest it's flat. And I am clueless. I do not understand why they include that to say the earth is flat. You know, if the Bible so clearly teaches the earth is flat, you'd think that somewhere in Scripture there'd be a verse that says something like the earth is flat. And I've read the Bible, and I'm sure many of you have read the Bible, and I bet you've never encountered anything like that, have you? Because it's not there. The Bible doesn't teach that, nor did the church ever teach that. What happens is flat earthers choose to read and understand certain passages a certain way, and then they take that interpretation back and impose it upon the Scripture. That's eisegesis. That's not exegesis. That's an improper way to handle Scripture. And one thing I've heard them criticize this at Answers in Genesis, they say, you people claim to say everything in the Bible is literal, but you don't really believe that because you have this figurative use quite a bit in these things. Well, as it turns out, if you read our website very carefully, you will find out that we don't say everything in the Bible is literal. Some Christian creationists, too, make this mistake. They say the Bible is literally true. As it turns out, there are a lot of non-literal things in the Bible. For instance, there are figures of speech and idioms. You know what those are? They're not literal things. Have you ever pulled anybody's leg before? I mean, grabbed their leg and started pulling. No, you didn't do that. You pull their leg. It's an idiom. It's a figure of speech saying, you know, you're fooling them. You're just joking with them. You're kind of teasing them or something. Try translating that into another language. I understand in German, the equivalent is you're taking me in your arms. If you say, oh, you're taking me in your arms, it's the same thing as you're pulling my leg. Those are examples, and there are many of those in the Bible as well. There are idioms and figures of speech that we really can't do there. There are similes as well. What's a simile? Something is like something. And Jesus told a lot of similes, didn't he? We call them parables. The kingdom of heaven is like this. Then there are metaphors. There are metaphors. For instance, at the Last Supper, Jesus started talking to his disciples and he said, I'm the vine and you're the branches. And then he started talking about pruning them. Was he literally a vine? Were they literally branches? No. There are many examples of metaphors in these things. And when you get in the poetic and the prophetic books of the Old Testament particularly, there are all sorts of symbolic things and allegorical themes present. And that's where why so many people disagree on what these passages mean, don't they? And many of the passages that flat earthers use to make their case come from the prophetic and the poetic books. And you need to be very careful when you do that. Now, some people are saying, well, wait a minute. If you admit some things in the Bible are not literally true, then you're going to undermine the 6 days of creation, the virgin birth of Jesus' bodily resurrection. No, not at all. You see, those things come from the narrative, historical narrative portions of the scriptures. And you might think, well, you might still get confused in this. No, you won't, because it's very easy to identify which passages of scripture are historical narrative and which ones are poetic and prophetic. It's not that hard. It really isn't to tell them apart. And when you come into Genesis, it does have some idioms and figures and speech, but you don't find the metaphors and the symbolism there like you would in the poetic and prophetic passages. So there's no danger there. We do believe that many things in the Bible are literal, but there are a lot of things that are figurative, and there's no problem in sorting them out. Now, one verse that they really like is Isaiah 40:22. It says, "It is he who sits on the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the globe of the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in." I underline circle of the earth, and they say, a circle is like this. A ball is not a circle. So they say, therefore, the Bible teaches that the earth is flat and round like this. Well, hold on. If you look at that Hebrew word there, what it actually means, it refers to something that's round. Let me ask you this. If I hadn't started this talk tonight, I'd ask you, what shape do you think the earth is? What would most of you say? Most of you'd say round, wouldn't you? Everybody says round. Well, I got news for you, folks. The earth, if the earth were shaped like this, it would be round, wouldn't it? But when you say the earth is round, most people don't mean a flat round, a circle, two-dimensional round. They mean a three-dimensional round, like a ball. And this word here, used in the Hebrew, refers to something round. Now, the flat earthers like to say elsewhere, by the way, they have this flat earth version there. You can see it's got Isaiah 40:22 there, and it's got the flat round earth. That's our model. You can see the North Pole is at the center. There is no South Pole, and there's an Antarctic ice wall around it, and that's the dome fits over top of that, beyond that ice wall somewhere. That's their model. And they say this is what the Bible teaches based on Isaiah 40:22. They furthermore say that elsewhere in the book of Isaiah, that Isaiah used a word which means ball. It says at one point, talking to Israel, I will toss you like a ball into the yard. They say, see, if he wanted to get across in Isaiah 40:22 that the earth is a ball, he would have used that word. Well, as it turns out, that word is used one other time in Isaiah. That flat earthers never like to talk about that one, because it's talking, when it uses that same word that they say must mean ball in every instance, it's talking about encircling a city and besieging it. When an army besieges a city, do they do it on a ball or do they do it in a circle? They do it in a two-dimensional circle, don't they? So they're not even consistent. The word that they want to use refers to something that's round. Both of them refer to something that's round, and it's ambiguous. I would love, by the way, many creationists have claimed Isaiah 40:22 as an indication in the Bible that the Bible teaches the earth is a globe. And I've talked to Hebraists about this, and they say, no, you can't say that. It says there's something round involved here. What does it exactly mean? We don't know, and commentators are all over the place on this one. I would love to claim this is a text verse proving the earth is a globe, but honesty prevents me from doing that. Anybody who's honest looking at these Hebrew words will recognize the fact that it's ambiguous. It's something that's round, and it's all you can say about it. Okay, does the earth have four corners? Isaiah 11:12 seems to say so. He will raise a signal for the nations and will assemble the banished of Israel and gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And once again in Revelation 7:1, it says, "After this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree." So the flat earthers quote these two verses and say, where do you have corners on a globe? You don't. Therefore, the earth cannot be a globe. I honestly don't understand how they can use that verse, because it applies to their preferred model too, doesn't it? just got to think about this for a minute. I mean, I find that just very naive that people can be led down this. Yeah, it can't be a globe, but it can't be this either, if that's what you're doing. By the way, this, I believe, is an idiomatic expression referring to the four directions, north, south, east, and west. And we still refer to that today. If you look up a weather forecast, it's detailed. They'll give the time and temperature, or the temperature and the wind direction and the speed, and they'll say it's like out of the south, southwest. They'll use those four directions still again. Also notice in Revelation 7:1, it does mention the angels and the winds there, right? That's what it's talking about. It's not a literal four corners. But I have to ask the question, which is it? Is it square or is it round? I mentioned Orlando Ferguson earlier with his 400 Bible verses. He printed this in the 1890s, and it's both flat and round with the angels on the corner. Kind of cheating, I think. And I notice it's kind of dimpled like this, kind of rises in the middle and dimples down. It resembles a roulette wheel to me. And so I call this the roulette wheel model. And I've been in discussion on, I belong to one Facebook discussion group about flat earth and globe earth, and it's moderated by globe earthers. So that way I feel there's a lot of toxic stuff out there, and I just avoid it for the most part. But I sometimes in a discussion in here, they'll point this verse out and say, well, how can you have corners on a flat earth? And they usually will pop this out, and I will ask them, do you really believe that's what the earth is like? And I usually don't get any kind of response. They're just kind of grasping at straws here. And I don't want to make fun of these people, but really, I wonder, are you really thinking these things through? Here's another one. How about the ends of the earth? It occurs 28 times in the Old Testament, the ends of the earth. For instance, Psalm 67:7 says, God shall bless us, let all the ends of the earth fear him. And Isaiah 45:22, turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. Now, on a globe, you can't have an end. You go around and around and around and around, and you will never reach the end of the earth. So on the base of these two passages and the other 26, the earth must not be a globe. It must be flat and round because there is an end here. You can reach the end, and you've reached the end of the earth, haven't you? Is this talking about geography, though, or real estate? Look very carefully what it says. It's a parallelism in the first one there. It says, God shall bless us. Let all the ends of the earth fear him. Can real estate fear God? No, it's not talking about land, it's talking about people. People living at the remotest parts of the earth. It's an idiomatic expression, once again, one of those non-literal uses. What about the second one? Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth. Can real estate be saved? I don't think so. It's talking about people, again, at the remotest parts of the earth. And another one they like to use is Daniel 4. They like to quote the 11th verse. It says, the tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Now, see, if you have a globe and you have this tree that grows up monstrously tall, at most half the earth can see it. The other half can't possibly see it. So therefore, they say, on a flat earth, you can have a tree here, and it grows up high enough, people all over the world can see it because the earth is flat, so this must indicate the earth is flat. Now, this is an example of where flat earthers will take a single verse, and many times they'll take even a word or two in a verse and focus on that and leave everything else out. But that's leaving out context. As it turns out, the book of Daniel, the chapter divisions are pretty good for the most part because Daniel 4 is a complete description of an account of something that happened. And that something was a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And he said, the visions of my head as I lay in my bed were these, I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. This is not a literal tree. It's a dream that had a tree in it with some unusual properties to it. I don't know about you, but my dreams are surreal. They're amazing. I'll tell you about one dream I had many, many years ago. I was in a big, large auditorium like this, and a giant rhinoceros came crashing through this wall and running up to me. By the time it got to me, it was my mother. I'm not making this up. And before I could say anything to my mother, she turned into a dove and flew off. And that's the kind of dreams I have. Are your dreams like that, folks? I mean, I wake up in the morning, I think, wow, that was a wild one. But I have all sorts of wild dreams, so why couldn't Nebuchadnezzar have a wild? Well, it was sent by God for a purpose. I want to make several points here. It was a dream. Did I mention it's a dream? It's a dream. It's mentioned in verses 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 18 and 19. Again and again and again and again. It said it's a dream. It's not a literal tree, folks. And it was a dream of a pagan king. Pagan, right? And the tree wasn't even a tree in the dream because Daniel interpreted the dream and he said, actually, King Nebuchadnezzar, I'm afraid to tell you this, but you are the tree. You see, the tree was representational. It wasn't really a tree. It was in a dream, but it wasn't even a tree. It was about Nebuchadnezzar. Now, there are literal things here. There really was a literal king. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it troubled him, literally, and he had trouble, and nobody could interpret it literally, but Daniel did literally interpret it, and he told him the message of what it was, and it was literally fulfilled. Great account there of what happened. The passage does not teach cosmology. It's not even clear if the dream reflected the cosmology of Nebuchadnezzar. I can never recall having a dream that I dreamed the earth is flat, but if I did, would that prove then that I believe the earth is flat? No, it doesn't. It just means I had a dream that the earth was flat. But again, he didn't dream the earth was flat. He dreamed about a tree, didn't it? Doesn't really prove much, does it? And on, I look at the arguments they bring, the biblical arguments, and they fall really flat, pardon the pun there. But they really don't work under the light of scrutiny. Now, what is the flat earth model? Well, I said it's a disc with the north pole at the center. And you got, say, North America here and Europe and Asia, and you get farther and farther out. Over here is Australia and South America and so forth. And there's an ice wall at the perimeter. There's no Antarctica, it's just an ice wall. No one's ever penetrated beyond that. Sorry, Admiral Byrd. And you've got this dome over top. And it's maybe not just a hemisphere. Maybe it's flattened a little bit like an arena that they build to hold sports events. And you've got the stars and the sun and the moon and that are just below. It's not clear. They vary from person to person. And each day, the whole thing spins around like this. Spins around, and that's what causes the sun to move and everything else to move around. That is their model. Now, if you notice something, if you've got a flat earth and you've got a sun up here, and it goes around like this, do you see a problem? The sun is always up. And how can you have sunset, sunrise, and how can it ever be dark? Well, they have an answer for that. Not a very good one, but they have an answer. Their answer is this. They say that the sun acts like a spotlight, and it shines down like this. And when you're under the lit portion of the spotlight, it's daytime. And when you're not, it's nighttime. And they've got a little GIF here that you can show. It goes around, and there's the sun moving around. It's lighting up part of the earth, and the moon is in that dark side just going around and around and around. And many flat earthers find this convincing, but the details are really problematic. For one thing, the sun is always above the horizon. If you have a dome over top of the earth, no matter where you are in that dome, we'd say mathematically there's a one-to-one correspondence between every point up here and every point on the surface. If the sun's over here and it's got a light shining down, it's still above the horizon. It never went below the horizon. I can actually take some numbers and I can use trigonometry and I can calculate how high it should be, and it would never fall below the horizon. Sunset is impossible. The sun's always up, but yet every night when it's clear, I see the sunset. Now, this idea, I can test this. I did this a few years ago. I've done it since, but I just got this great test I did. If I'm here in northern Kentucky and the sun's doing this, notice it's coming toward me and then moving away from me, toward me and moving away from me. And so around local noon, the sun should be at its closest. Now, I ask you, what do you notice about an object as it gets closer to you and as it gets farther away from you? What do you notice? It appears to get smaller, doesn't it? It appears to get smaller. That's due to perspective, something that flat earthers like to talk about a lot, but they don't take the lesson very well. Everybody understand what I'm saying? When something's farther away, it looks smaller. We all know that's the case. So if that's the case, we ought to see the sun getting smaller and getting larger throughout the day and then getting smaller again later in the day. So I tested this few years ago. I went out on this date. Common claim is that the sun is 3,000 miles high and it's 32 miles across. It's a very common claim. Not every flat earther will claim that, but that's a common claim. As it turns out, it doesn't matter. In the mathematics I do here, the actual distance of the height of the sun above the earth cancels out. Doesn't matter. So it's arbitrary. But I use that to start with. It doesn't rise or set. It's a matter of perspective here. So I did this on 2016 on August 3rd. I went out early in the morning at 7:30 Eastern Daylight Time, And I took a photograph of the sun with my Questar telescope. I had the sun filter on it because, well, it's too much light. And I took that picture. And why did I take it that late in the morning? Well, there were trees in the way, and I had to wait until it was above the trees. But it was 8 degrees high at that point. And then I went out at local noon, and local noon for us was at 1:45. That's because of daylight stupid time. And so it was 1:45, and it was 63 degrees high. And taking that bit of information, I was able to calculate that if I took a photograph, the sun in the second photograph ought to be 6.4 times larger than the other. And if you don't believe me, I've written this up, and you can go through the math and tell me where I made a mistake. If I made a mistake, I would quickly correct that. But it's been 6-7 years since I published this, and not a single flat earther has said, oh, you made a mistake here. They haven't, because the math is done right. So, you want to see the photographs? Yeah, okay. Here's the first one. And there it is. There's the first one. And you'll see the sun is kind of orange looking and kind of dim. That's because, well, you know when the sun's low in the sky, it's dim and it's orange. That's from scattering in the atmosphere. And you'll notice there's a little bit of tree at the from the 4:30 position, a little bit of branch in front of that. You see that? That's because it's just getting above the trees. Now, what I did is I came back several hours later when it was local noon. And I made sure that I used the same ISO setting, the same exposure time. Everything, as far as the photographs are concerned, are completely identical. So no one can say, oh, you changed your settings. No, the same settings for both of them. And here's the one, and you can see very clearly that it is 6.4 times larger, isn't it? Well, no, it's not. But to be sure, what I did is I took both of these, and these represented the same scale, but I printed them on paper, a big legal-sized paper, and I measured them very carefully with a ruler, and I compared them, and it was like 1 millimeter difference out of like 170 millimeters or something. And that was due to probably just the fact of the wrinkling paper as it goes through the printer. If I want to print a little better, I could do better if I could do pixels. That would work as well. So this claim utterly fails, doesn't it? Unless you're just going to throw perspective out the window and claim the sun maintains the same size throughout the day. Other false claims, they say, I've seen this many times, and they claim the North Star is visible well into the southern hemisphere. Well, obviously, they've not tested this for themselves. I've made 10 trips to the southern hemisphere. I have yet to see the North Star in that part of the sky. As I get toward the equator, I see it getting lower and lower and lower, and then it's not there anymore. So this claim is also false. As an astronomer, I've tested it, but I know better than that. But unfortunately, most people who believe the Earth is flat don't know enough about these things to know it's false. They just repeat these false claims. And then we look at the circular patterns. When I showed the picture taken of the Ark Encounter, they say that that pattern of stars can only happen on a flat Earth. They say it wouldn't happen on a globe Earth. Well, hold on a minute. If the stars are going in circles like this, if you're at the North Pole and looking up, you will see a circular pattern. But what if you're off to the side? If you look at a circle off axis, doesn't look like this, it looks like that. That is an undeniable fact of geometry. It's impossible to get circles out of that unless you're on the axis of that circle. And I may have a photograph I can show this to you, but here's what I'm talking about. There is the top of the dome there is the where the North Celestial Pole or Polaris, let's say, would be, and the stars are going to go in a circle like that. So if I'm off to the lower right, like that first little line I just showed you, I'm not looking at the circle like this. I'm looking at it like that. It's going to look elliptical. So I went into the planetarium there at the Creation Museum, and I had the operator of the planetarium spin the stars in a circle around the top of the dome. And I set my camera up off-centered, and I got it high up levels as I could with the bottom of the dome, and I took a 30-second exposure. And this is what I got. I was mimicking what would happen if you're not at the North Pole of the flat Earth over here, and what would you see in the sky? And very clearly, as I said, you're going to see ellipses in the sky, not a circle. But every time you put up a photograph like this, it's always a circle. Even the flat Earthers put a circle, but they could pretend to say that that only happens if the Earth is flat. And that's false, clearly false. Just following the geometry. Well, I got into time-lapse photography a few years ago. By the way, I took this one. It's a 30-minute exposure in the White Mountains in Arizona at 8,300 feet. You see that little bit of red and green glow near the bottom, the horizon? That's a faint aurora. I didn't even see it with my eye, but the camera picked that up. I didn't know something about a month later. But I've taken a lot of time-lapse. This is one of my first time-lapse attempts. This is, you can see the peak of my house, the front door is below that. Right above that peak is Polaris. If you look to the upper left, can you see the Big Dipper? And if I put it in motion, this is only an hour's worth of motion, but you can see everything's spinning counterclockwise around the North Star. Now, if I turn around and look to the south, everything will go clockwise, but I won't see the center of rotation like I did there. The center of rotation is very close to Polaris. It's because it's below the horizon. But if I go to the southern hemisphere and do the same thing, I've only done this a couple of times. This was taken in South Africa. We had a bright moon that night, kind of bad, but you can see the glow of the Milky Way going from lower left to the upper right and a couple of small satellite galaxies. There is no South Star, but watch what happens. It will spin in a clockwise pattern, and the center of rotation is to the right of center, just above the trees there. There are not one, but two points of rotation in the sky, but that happens on a globe Earth. But on a flat domed Earth, there's only one point of rotation. So why do we see two points of rotation in the sky? And why do we only see one of them in the northern hemisphere and the other one in the southern hemisphere? Again, that makes perfect sense on a globe Earth. It makes no sense at all on a flat Earth. Now, in order to believe the Earth is flat, you must believe a lot of other things. You must believe that there's a massive conspiracy out there to hide the truth. Astronauts have to be in it, probably heads of state, a lot of people at NASA besides the astronauts, astronomers like me have to be in it, a lot of people have to be in on it. So who's behind all of this? Well, there are three groups that come to mind very quickly. One would be the Freemasons, they like to pick on them. Another one's the Jesuits, they like to pick on them. And the other one's the Jews, the Zionists. And all three get brought in, Freemasons, the Jesuits, and the Jews. But this latter group has really been picked out. There's a guy out there named Edward Hendry. He's written two books on this. And the first book was very, very foul. There's what I'm going to give you is just one sentence from a paragraph. One sentence from another paragraph. This book is called The Greatest Lie on Earth, Proof That Our World Is Not a Moving Globe. He says, communism is essentially Talmudic Judaism. Do not think that Jews are ignorant of the fact that Satan is the god of their religion. This evil doctrine can also be seen in the Talmud, where incest, fornication, adultery, etc. are promoted as virtues and something to be desired. The ritual sacrifice of Gentile children by Jews had led to repeated banishments of Jews from one nation after another throughout history. And this went on for 160 pages, I think. And this is a few. I actually pulled out snippets, probably several dozen. Remember that discussion group I told you about? On Facebook, I posted that a few years ago. And I asked flat earthers, would you condemn this? No response. Flat earthers, please condemn this. This rank anti-Semitism, and they wouldn't. And I pleaded repeatedly, please. One of them came back and said, well, I'm sure there have been some globe earthers that are anti-Semitic too. I said, fine, give me a name, give me a reference, and I will condemn them so fast it will make your head swim. Despite my repeated pleas, not one flat earther would say, yes, this is vile, rank anti-Semitism, hatred, and bigotry. Not one. And that frightens me. In fact, they defended it. They defended it. That's highly offensive to me, extremely offensive, and I'll be offensive to you. That is not the love of Christ. This is a very serious offense, folks. There's rampant anti-Semitism. I'm not saying all flat earthers are anti-Semitic, but I'm having a hard time finding even one that will condemn the anti-Semitism in their ranks. And finally I said, look, I've gone on for days. I've repeatedly asked you to. Since nobody will condemn it, I must assume then, if you have ample opportunity, you must agree with it then. That's a reasonable conclusion to make, isn't it? After they've been given ample opportunity again and again and again and again, and they refuse to do it. And that's frightening. Well, you know, if the earth is flat, nothing can orbit the earth. There's a dome there. And the moon doesn't orbit the earth either. It just goes in circles. There are no satellites. For that matter, there are no astronauts. And we certainly haven't landed on the moon. However, there are at least two Christian men who walked on the moon, Charlie Duke and the late Jim Irwin. I've had the pleasure of knowing Charlie Duke, interacted with him several times, worked with his niece and was a good friend of his identical twin brother. My adopted hometown is his real hometown, as it turns out, Lancaster, South Carolina. And if you are going to say that these people are lying about one of the biggest things that ever happened to them, then you're guilty of accusing two Christian brothers of lying. And that is a serious charge. You better be prepared to back it up, not with your claims that the earth is flat. And otherwise, you need to be finding evidence why they're lying and the fact that they're not born-again men at all. I asked Charlie Duke to give me a reference. He said sure. He said, I was the lunar module pilot of the Apollo 16 mission to the moon. We launched from the Kennedy Space Center in '72. We left Earth orbit for our three-day trip to the moon about 3 hours later. As we maneuvered our spacecraft to dock with our lunar module, the Earth came into view about 20,000 miles away. It was an awesome sight. As you can see in the photo, the Earth, is obviously a sphere and not a flat circle. As we journeyed to the moon, we could look out our windows and see a smaller Earth, and each time we could see different land masses, so it was obviously rotating on its axis. Testimony of a devout Christian man who I trust, and you ought to as well. Jeffrey Williams, he is another Christian. I've met him, have an assignment book that he made, the work of his hands. He took more photographs of the Earth from the space station than any other astronaut, and he wrote it in this book. And by the way, the work of his hands is talking about our Creator, the Lord God of the Bible. If the Earth is flat, then he's lying too. Please give me evidence or give me proof that he's a liar about all of this. Since then, I've got to know Barry Wilmore. Did an interview with him just last week. He's been to the station, been on the shuttle, and he's a Christian man, and I believe I've got four Christian witnesses now, three of which I know personally, that tell me, yeah, the Earth is a globe. I've been up high enough to see it, and it is. There's one of the photographs. It shows the Earth is indeed a globe. Okay, what is the flat earthers' motivation? Why are they doing this? Well, I am convinced some of them are well-intentioned. They really do mean well, but they're just misguided and wrong. There are some people who are doing this as a prank. Some of these are just downright malicious. I think they're doing it to make Christians look foolish and to discredit Scripture. And I have a hard time telling who the real believers are sometimes, but some of these people are wonderful people and they really mean well, but I just feel sorry for them and my heart goes out to them because they've been so misled by all of this. And it's really sad. If you want to know more, I do have written a book, Falling Flat. We have it for sale back there. And as long as we have them, if we sell out, you'll have to order it or something. We also have a DVD we don't have with us, Faith on the Edge. And you can order that or get to pick that up from us, or you can pick it up when you're there visiting the Creation Museum. You also, I have like 30 articles or blogs on flat earth. If you go to our website, answersingenesis.org, and just type search flat earth, it will come up, all of those, and you get a lot of information there. But I thank you very much for letting me come speak tonight. I've enjoyed being here, and we're going to have the pastoral staff come up, I think, and close us out. Oh, there he is. Thank you.
Appreciate Dr. Faulkner sharing, and again, it's been a great day. Yeah, all these teachings will be online. Give us a few days, and you go back and watch these. So let's close out in prayer tonight as we leave. Well, Father, we do love you, God, and we thank you. God, we thank you that we are on solid ground believing your book, Lord, believing your word. God, thank you that you give us proofs, Lord, that we're not just... We're not just having to believe these things blindly. Lord, you've shown us clearly, Father, that what you said is true, and we can stand on it, Lord. And so give us strength to stand on it in this day and age in which we live, that we might proclaim you, God, in this world, and they would know the God that we follow, the God that we love, and the God that ultimately died on that cross for our sins. So, Father, use these things that we've been taught, Lord, make us better witnesses of you, and, Lord, send us out now. Lord, to shine your light in this world. We love you and we thank you and we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.